Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with the author Fiona Barton, whose new novel is Local, Gone Missing, published by Berkeley. Fiona Barton's debut, The Widow, was a Sunday Times and New York Times bestseller and has been published in 36 countries and optioned for television. Her second novel, The Child, was a Sunday Times bestseller. Born in Cambridge, Fiona currently lives in Sussex and Southwest France. Previously, she was a senior writer at the Daily Mail, news editor at the Daily Telegraph, and chief reporter at the Mail on Sunday, where she won Reporter of the Year at the British Press Awards. While working as a journalist, Fiona Barton reported on many high-profile criminal cases, and she developed a fascination with watching those involved, their body language, and verbal tics. Fiona interviewed people at the heart of these crimes, from the guilty to their families, as well as those on the periphery, and found that it was those just outside the spotlight who interested her most. Her new novel, Local Gone Missing, concerns Detective Elise King, who investigates a man's disappearance in a seaside town where the locals and weekenders are at odds. Elise is a successful and ambitious detective, or she was before a medical leave left her unsure if she would ever return to work. She now spends most days watching the growing tensions in her small seaside town of Ebbing, the weekenders renovating old bungalows into luxury homes, and the locals resentful of the changes. Elise can only guess what really happens behind closed doors, but Dee Eastwood, her house cleaner, often knows. She's an invisible presence in many of the houses in town, but she sees and hears everything. The conflicts boil over when a newcomer wants to put the town on the map with a weekend music festival, and two teenagers overdose on drugs. When a man disappears the first night of the festival, Elise starts digging for answers. Ebbing is a small town, but it's full of secrets and hidden connections that run deeper and darker than Elise could have ever imagined. My interview with Fiona Barton begins with my first question for her. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Before we even get to the new novel, I wanted to just start talking about your background in journalism, because I think that must really help you as you're writing these. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure. I was a journalist for more than 30 years. So it was all I wanted to do, as a child, really. My dad was a journalist and he worked from home. So it was like growing up in a newsroom. And so I wanted to do that too. I've worked on, daily papers. I've been a general news reporter covering, stories of every stripe, really. But what it gave me was an outlet for writing, obviously. And I've always been a passionate reader from a very early age. And so I was happy. I was writing and I was reading. And it was only when I stopped being a reporter that I thought, I wonder if I could write something different. And so that's when I tried. And The Widow, my first book, was the result of that. But it's what I've got from my 30 years of journalism is this cast of characters that I can draw on. I've met people from every walk of life, and lots of those meetings and the conversations we had have stayed with me, and I've been able to dip in and find dialogue, characterization, locations. So I've been very lucky to have that resource.
I bet. That's wonderful. How much time was there between retiring and starting to work on fiction?
It was pretty straight away, really.
Yeah.
Because as a journalist, I was working very long hours. I was a news editor of a daily paper, and then I was a feature writer and, going off all over the place. So I didn't have time or space really in my head to even think about this. But once I stopped, my husband and I decided to go abroad. We went as volunteers to Sri Lanka. Mm-hmm. And when I got there, obviously I missed writing. And I had this idea, I had this voice in my head. And so I did have a go then. But I wrote 10 chapters, first 9 and the last chapter. And then I put it in a drawer, like you do, and took it out again a couple of years later. So there was a gap, but actually starting, there wasn't much of a gap, really.
You kind of had a sense of what you were going to do next.
Yeah, I guess so.
So let's talk about Local Gone Missing, which is your new mystery novel. And this is a new detective for you. Elise is not somebody you've written about before, correct? Do you think this will be a series, or are you not sure yet?
Well, I'm writing the second one at the moment.
Okay, so it will.
I've got to hand it in on the 1st of October. So, I'm well into the second one. And I've really enjoyed writing some different characters. So that's been great.
Yeah. I enjoyed this very much. So what a creepy opening. Let's just start there. We'll start with your opening. You have this great hook. Something is buzzing, and then it's a fly. And then we come to realize that there's a person in a room bound up, unable to move. Lots of unanswered questions. So first of all, great opening. But secondly, I wondered if you can speak to how far you can take this kind of opening to hook a reader without it being too much, which it wasn't. But I could see that it, you know, you have to be careful probably. What do you think?
Yeah, I've never used a prologue before. I'd started the book at chapter one. And I felt that I needed something, as you say, to hook the reader in. So I did it very quickly because it was right at the end. I mean, I'd finished the book. It was at that point that I thought, I wonder if that would work. So I gave it a go, but I wrote it straight off. I get what you're saying. You don't want to give too much away. You also don't want to frighten the reader off by making it too lurid. So I hope it fit that bill.
It did. The thing I think that's interesting is you could do a very lurid opening and attract a certain audience, but I imagine your audience likes something that's a little cozier. Am I right? I feel like your tone is kind of, your tone is light, even if the subject matter is dark. I have a question about that later. And there's like a wonderful humor running through it. So I feel like in your case, your prologue has to be a little bit different than, for example, I don't know, Silence of the Lambs or something like that.
Just slightly. So, and also, I'm terribly squeamish. So I don't really, I don't know, you know, in the books that I've written, people have said two things. One is that why didn't you describe the crime? And on the other side, saying we liked that you didn't. And really, it was because I don't like, you know, lurid bloodletting, that sort of book. I don't enjoy them, so I'm certainly not going to write them. Mm-hmm. So what happens isn't as interesting to me as why it happens, and a bit of the how. But, you know, the actual horror, I keep well away. And I've always found it much more terrifying, actually, if it isn't painted, you know, in great splashy colours. You know, listening to trials during my journalistic career, you would get a very oblique look from the defendant because they didn't want to face it. They didn't mm-hmm. want to. And so you would get this slightly spooky, creepy, and then that happened as if it's happening in the third person. And I thought that was an interesting thing. It was an interesting look at how people face the crimes that they've done.
Right.
So I'm sort of stuck with that. I mean, really, that prologue is probably as lurid as I'll get, I hope.
Well, the other thing is that, and I know there's this famous quote that I'm not going to come up with, but, you know, what we can think of, what we can imagine is always going to be worse than
always.
Yeah, right? My next question sort of touches on something you've just mentioned, which is the way you approach filling in this world that you're creating. So, for example, at one point you have a description of a big house that looks special from a distance, as you put it, but as you get closer, it's falling apart, right? And similarly, there's this character who goes to visit his daughter, Charlie. He becomes a very important character. It was still an automatic gesture after all those years. He raises his hand to wave to her. And I knew she was blind before you told us she was blind because of that all those years. And so it's like you use these details to tell a story and you let them sort of preface the story before you fill it all in. And I really like that. And I think that's a little bit related to what we were just saying about your prologue.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the house, we used to live in France and there was a house just like that. From a distance, it looked Hollywood. But when you got close, there were great holes in it and the windows were all broken. And I liked that sort of, you know, you think you know what this house looks like, but actually when you get up close, it's not that at all.
Wonderful. Let's see. So that chapter I was just mentioning is from the point of view of a character, as I said, named Charlie, and he becomes very important. So then we move into the narrative point of view of a character named Dee, who I'm going to talk about more in a minute. But right now, I mostly want to talk about changing narrators and deciding who tells the story and from whose perspective you want to share what happened.
Yeah. I think this is certainly a hangover from being a reporter, because I've always told stories from different narrators, because that's what we do. We talk to lots of people. We have lots of voices in a story. You know, you always want to get every perspective, if you can, as many as you can. And so that sort of comes naturally to me. And I'm interested in how people see things differently. I suppose the story is about insiders and outsiders in a way. So the insiders are people like Dee, who's a cleaning lady. And so she sees everybody's house. She sees their lives very intimately, really, even though it doesn't strike people that she does. And the outsider is Elise, the detective who's just moved in. So I really wanted to see what they thought about the people, their neighbours, the people they work for, from that different angle. It's what interests me. So that's what I do. It's not, you know, it's always very complicated. I never make things easy. And again, you know, in the second one of the series, I've got three different narrators. But I like the way that plays. I like the way that, you know, it can take the reader in one direction and then the next chapter you can say, oh, but hang on a minute. You know, she may say that, but what about this? So I like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Elise, as a point of view character, was kind of my favorite. And and it's interesting because she wasn't your first or second narrator, but when we get to her, I feel like I've found my grounding in the book. I don't know how you did that, but it worked, I thought, because obviously she's a very important character. She's going to be investigating. So she's off duty due to a cancer battle. She's recovering from chemotherapy. And so she's not, at the beginning of the book, she's not on the clock, so to speak. And she says at one point, from her own point of view, she'd got all the time in the world now, which to me was interesting because it spoke to the fact that she's bored at home, which she is. She's really bored. But also there was this sort of, in that to me, and maybe I'm reading too much into it, but there was almost this little promise from the author of the kind of slow unfurling of information and that the reader could just sort of like, relax. We have all the time in the world to tell the story. So I've got a couple questions in there. First of all, just talk a little bit about finding Elise and developing her character. And maybe if you have any ideas as to why on chapter 5 or whatever, I found her so grounding. I don't know.
Well, I found Elise because I wanted, because the first three books were written largely around a journalist character, Kate Walters, who barged her way in, as journalists do. Any good journalist would do. So she barged in and refused to leave. So I wrote three books with her. which I loved doing. But at the end of book three, I thought, this woman needs a lie down. So I started thinking about investigators, and I've worked alongside, you know, police officers when I've been doing stories. So I've got to know them. And I did have a police officer in my first three, Bob Sparks. But I was interested to know what it would be like for a senior detective to be challenged, you know, to be in challenging circumstances. And I didn't want her to be an alcoholic and, you know, the usual tropes. So I thought, what would happen? Various friends of mine have had breast cancer. And I wondered what it would be like for a senior detective to be faced with that. I talked to some senior murder detectives who have had breast cancer, in particular two fantastic women who were very open and frank with me about, you know, what it's like to doubt yourself, to see people looking at you differently. And so I decided I would I'd take a character at her lowest ebb and see where she goes from there. So that's how Elise came into being, really. She's a woman in her early 40s who thought she knew exactly where her life was going. Ambitious, she didn't want children, she had a partner who she thought wanted the same thing, and everything going well. And then suddenly everything's turned upside down. So loses the partner in fairly sort of brutal circumstances, and finds that she has breast cancer. And at the beginning, she doesn't want to tell anybody because she doesn't want people to think of her differently. And it's about her kind of, I hate to say going on a journey because that's such a cliche, but it is in a way, because she's sitting at home thinking she'll never be the same woman she was before. How can she ever go back to work? And luckily she has this wonderful neighbor, Ronnie, my favorite character.
Right, that's going to be another one of my questions.
my nosy neighbor, who is so thrilled to have a murder detective living next door. She is determined not to waste the opportunity. So she drags poor Elise out of her apathy and gets her involved in looking for Charlie, the local who's gone missing, and people are not terribly interested for various reasons. But and then it's how it's slightly amateurish investigation starts, but it then takes several dark turns, and Elise finds herself again.
Yeah.
Or finds the detective again.
Yeah.
So that's how it started. And I just loved Elise. She's very matter of fact, grounded, as you say. And, you know, she's a woman with, you know, all the weaknesses and vulnerability of any other.
Right.
Yeah.
I thought that her situation, it's interesting because you didn't want the alcoholic, you didn't want the same old tropes. Another thing, though, is that she gets to be a private investigator for a little while in this book without being a private investigator, right? So, and that was interesting, too, because she's not officially on duty, she can take slightly different paths, but she still has access to some of the professional research that she needs. And then she can also kind of go off with Ronnie, which was great. Ronnie's a wonderful character in both literature terms and in the term of she's such a character.
She is.
She's really
yes. She's the humor,
right,
in it, largely.
Right. And then there's also Caro, who's also, you know, a great character, who's Elise's more official partner.
She's the DS. She's the sergeant. From her team that she's worked with since they were newbies together, and they've been through various things together. But Caro is very different. Elise is slightly OCD, very orderly, knows what she's doing, which is why it's so devastating when everything goes skyward.
Punches out of control.
Harrow is a bit more chaotic, but very instinctive and good instincts. So they work well together.
Yeah, that's great. Here's a question for you. Now, I know because of your background in journalism, you probably know all kinds of things about police procedure. But when a writer doesn't know about police procedure, what do you recommend? Do you think that they should just read a lot of news reports? Do you think they should go talk to the police? I'm sure there are probably books that tell you how to approach police procedure.
I have a stack of them, actually, beside my laptop. These are all, I've got The Mind of a Murderer, How to Solve a Crime, The Crime Writer's Handbook. You think you know about police procedure if you're covering stuff, and you do. But, I stopped being a reporter in 2008, so things have changed somewhat. So I have relied very heavily on senior police officers giving me some of their time, which is so generous of them. But, yeah, I mean, there's no substitute. I can read all amount of these books. But actually saying to a detective, right, I want to do this, and he'll say, or she'll say, no, we wouldn't do that. We'd do this. So it isn't all just naysaying. It's, this is what we'd do. So at the moment, I've got a terrific former chief superintendent, I think he was, who is advising me and being very generous and very funny about it as well.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Spotting my terrible errors.
Oh, that's so great to find somebody who can help you in that way, because that's so important to be accurate.
It is. And I've got a pathologist, a criminal, forensic pathologist who does the same. Tells me where I'm going wrong.
One thing I wanted to ask you about is embedding details that might or might not be clues. There was one moment where one of your characters is sort of describing herself, and then at a certain moment, there's like a separate sentence that says, I can't remember the exact sentence, but it was something along the lines of, I'm not local. And to me, that sentence, the fact that it was a separate sentence from the long list of things that she was, I'm not local, it jumped out at me. And I thought, is that a clue? Or is that underpinning the way that this area is full of full-time residents and also tourists and weekenders and seasonal homeowners? So I was thinking, that could be pointing to either of those things. So I'm not saying that it was a clue, but it made me wonder and want to ask you about putting clues in so that when your reader finishes, she might say, oh, now I get that. But it's not obvious. I mean, that's going to be really hard.
I know. It's hard, that. It is hard because, as a reporter, what I learned to do was to tell the whole story in the first paragraph. That's what you do. Okay, that's not great for a thriller.
So it's not very thrilling.
Drip. And often, this morning I wrote a piece, I wrote a bit, and I thought, I need to flag that up earlier. So I went back, I found places where I could just, I like to keep it subtle, because otherwise there's no fun in it, is there?
Right.
So that's what I do. So I'll, the story may change because I don't plot it all out. And today I wrote a bit and I thought, that's what happened. Fine. But I need to say early, in chapter three or whatever, that something had happened that would set that up. So that's what I did.
Mm-hmm. Now, what is your writing process like? Do you kind of really sit down and just kind of like just free write a first draft, or are you tinkering as you, obviously you're saying you go back and do a little bit of in integrating detail maybe or clues, but do you tend to do a full first draft pretty quickly and then go back and make changes, or no
I don't. There are authors who do that. Kazuo Ishiguro does dirty writing, he calls it. I love it. I just love to see him do it. Where he sits down for a month and just writes.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't stop. He says he doesn't stop. He just carries on. I can't do that. And it's, the way I've always written is that you edit as you go along. So I'll write, very happy to, sit and write, 1,000, 2,000 words. But then I will go back over it. So my first draft, isn't entirely a first draft. It is, but it has been, it's been gone over several times. It's just, you know, I can't unlearn that. I wish I could. I can't even do it with spellings. And, you know, that I'll be typing and I'll think, oh, I've spelled that wrong. Go back. So, you know, it's, yeah. And, yeah, it's just the way I do it. It's fine. And then I send my draft one to the editors who'll read it. And then I'll do a draft two, maybe a draft three. You know, it's a process. It's a collaborative process, really.
Have they ever given you feedback that required a really big rewrite?
Oh, God, yes.
Is that a pain?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. And there's this lovely sort of romantic vision of writers sitting in at their desks and sending it off and it's printed, and unfortunately not.
No.
So my second book, I rushed to finish it because I'd never written to deadline as a writer, as a fiction writer before. So I thought, you know, the main thing was to get it in on time. That's my journalist head. And so I did, and I wasn't happy with it. And there was a bit of a silence, and my lovely editors came back and said, would you like a bit more time? I.e., this is rubbish. Could you do something with it? So I rewrote the second 40,000 words.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. All right.
Great. And that, you know, and that's fine. It's hard to hit it on the nail, you know, the first time.
Sure. Yeah. Let's see. So Dee, your cleaning lady character, regularly sort of mentions how she is not a gossip, but she knows a lot, and she's certainly a window for us into this town and its people. There are gossips, though. Like, you have this wonderful postal worker, Postie Val. She's a gossip, and she knows who's getting what in the mail, and she talks about it, which is not okay. But anyway, so I wonder, I mean, it's kind of obvious that gossip would be valuable in a small town police narrative. But I wondered if this, I don't know, is this representative? Did you value, you must have valued gossips as a journalist. Did people, were people just bursting to tell you things when you would be going around investigating a story?
Some people were, some people weren't. But Postie Val, I mean, she's worked, she's done her postal route for a very long time, and she knows everybody. That's the thing. So it's not, it's sort of... it's a social thing, really. Yeah, she shouldn't be talking about it, obviously, because it's confidential. But she does, which is lucky for me, really, because otherwise nobody would know things. No, she's a good conduit. I'm not. I've got a lovely post lady here who never gossips, but she and Ronnie together are friends and have known each other a long time, and so she does tell Ronnie things, and Ronnie tells Elise.
Now, let's see. In addition to changing narrators, you move through time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, sometimes just in short spurts, this many days forward or back. But I wonder if you can talk about how that affects the tension of a narrative.
Well, I hope that it ramps it up. But the danger is that it will confuse the reader. So we went back and forth about how to title the time lapse. Because it is quite tricky, because it's quite most of it is quite a short time lapse. It's, you know, 2 weeks before, 1 week later. So, but I wanted the reader to have seen what had happened, you know, 2 weeks before, and how that then fitted in. So that's why I did that. And I have done that before in the other books. I've done timelines going back and forth. I'm not sure in this one that I'm writing at the minute, I'm actually not doing that. So at the moment, it may all change. But I don't mind doing that, because I like a bit of, you know, but hang on a minute, 2 weeks ago, this happened. So how does that change this? Again, never, you know, simple, but yeah. I hope it's I hope it's effective.
I think so. I think it's effective. And I was trying to figure out what makes it exciting to move around in time, but it is. It's just, I don't know, makes it sort of fun because you have to, I mean, I think part of the excitement of reading a book like this is you're trying to put it together as you go.
Yeah.
So to the extent that,
and then you're given a new piece of information from whenever it was.
Right, right. Yeah.
So it kind of changes things. So I quite like that jarring, you know, of expectation and what you think you know.
Absolutely. Well, I mentioned this before, but I wanted to just talk a little bit more about it. The tone is kind of light. I think part of that is because Ronnie is center stage and she's pretty funny. And there's, you know, a lot of your characters have a good sense of humor. But as I said, some of the subject matter is very dark. You know, you've got that buzzing fly and the two teenagers who overdose at a festival. They have to be hospitalized. You know, that's scary stuff. So how do you manage humor next to these kinds of moments? How do you, I thought you did a wonderful job finding the right tone, but I'm wondering how challenging that is.
Well, yeah, it is tricky. You're right. It's quite a balance because you don't want to make light of horrible things. But I think it can be a bit grinding if it's always that kind of dark tone. Mm-hmm. For my books, other books, you know, there are writers that do it brilliantly. Those, you know, really dark, dark, those really dark, dark works. But I like a joke. And so do the police. You know, you've heard of gallows humour.
Yeah.
When things are grim, sometimes you need just something, somebody to say something that will make you laugh, or, you know, just to cut through, because otherwise it's so hard to deal with, you know, constant misery and horror. That's why, you know, police and journalists laugh at all the wrong things.
Yeah. Okay, great. I always like to ask my guests what books they've read lately that they might recommend to listeners, other people's books. It can be fiction. It doesn't have to be. Do you have anything that you've read lately that you would recommend?
I'm reading the new Jessie Burton, the follow-up to The Miniaturist, called The House of Fortune, which I'm loving. It's great. I love The Miniaturist. And so, yeah, loving that. I have just read... and I think I've come to it after everybody else, The Suspicions of Mr. Witcher, which is by Kate Summerscale. And it's a true crime from the Victorian era and introduces the first Victorian proper detective, Mr. Witcher. It's all true. She's done immaculate research, and it's a horrible crime. Murder of a child. Okay. But it's just done so brilliantly. She knows what every building looks like, what every person was like. You know, she's really, I don't know how long she took to research it, but I loved it. And there's some really good insights into the human psyche as well. She's clever, very clever.
Wonderful. Okay, great. And you said you're working on the next one of these. Can you say anything about it or not yet?
Well, Elise is still there.
Okay.
And so is Ronnie. And so is Caro, actually. But there are a number of new characters. I feel if I say something now, the whole thing might change. And then
it's fine. But people are so funny. Some people will tell me a blow by blow, and some people are very like superstitious, like, oh my god, no, I can't talk about it, then it'll
go
away.
The trouble is that until you finished it, you don't know what it's about.
Yeah, really.
I mean, you know, you do, but you know, by once you've actually done it, you think, okay, that's what it was about. I thought it was about this, but no, hang on a minute, I think it could be about that. So yeah, it's very character led because that's why I like writing. And it's another investigation.
How far are you into it?
I'm 60,000 words in. So I've got another about 15,000, 20,000 words to go.
Yeah.
Okay, wonderful. Your plot, I'm not giving anything away about this book, I hate spoilers, but your plot has twists and turns, and it's really fun because all of a sudden something will happen and it's like, oh. But that made me wonder, what do you do when you don't know what's going to happen next? And I mean, do you get stuck? What do you do?
Yeah, sometimes I do, obviously, but I don't plot it out, because somebody said the other day, it takes the joy out of writing if you've already written it, you know, in a spreadsheet. So I know who my characters are. I don't know everything. I don't know what sort of biscuits they like. You know, I don't do a deep dive because I like to find out some things. But there are moments where I think, oh God, would she have done that? Or should she do that? And I just, you know, I'll go for a long walk or you know, stare at the wall and have a think about it. But you do discover as you go along, which is great. You know, it's fun.
It is fun
to play that game.
How much time?
And you know that you can always scrub it out and go back and do it a different way. So, yeah.
How much time do you tend to have for a next first draft?
18 months.
Oh, okay.
Normally, I have 18 months. No, it's about a year for the first draft, and then, you know, the triddling about. So it's about 18 months from first idea to delivery.
They'd like to start working on getting it out. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right. So this is my last question. You have a lot of characters. You have a lot going on. You've mentioned this before. So do a lot of wonderful writers. Agatha Christie did that. I'm wondering if you have advice for keeping yourself organized, advice for other writers for keeping organized when you have so many characters, storylines, narrators, clues. Yeah, there's a lot to keep track of, I would think.
Yes. I'd like to say that I'm very organized, but I'm not. I'm not really. I do have a character spreadsheet to make sure that I remember how old they are. Terrible with ages. You know, various small essential things about them. Color of hair. Goodness, it's so easy to forget. So I have got a spreadsheet of characters and how they relate to each other. And I've carried that on from the last book. So that's been good. I try and do a timeline, which is much more important when you're back and forth, you know, when you're skipping forward and back. But I keep forgetting to fill it in. So sometimes I do it at the end. It's a bit shameful.
That's a good check to make sure you haven't messed anything up.
That's true. Yes, I do that. I do that. But no, my desk is a mess. And I have a whiteboard with a sort of a terribly childlike map of Ebbing here.
Oh, yeah.
Which I drew. I thought I'd better work out where the roads went and here. And yeah.
I noticed that Elise has post-it notes in different colors. I thought maybe you have post-it notes in different colors.
I have, but I don't use them. You see, Elise,
she's organized.
My nemesis, really, because she's so organized, and that's fine. You know, that's how her brain works. Mine's not very good at that. I mean, I am organized about some things, but when things are sort of swirling around a bit, you know, you don't want to pin everything down too early. Mm-hmm. My editor will cry when she hears this, because she would love me to be more organized. What's your story arc? I'm a plunger.
And you don't know where you're going, right? I mean, I know that you don't outline, but sometimes. Do you know who done it?
Sometimes. Not always. The first book, I knew exactly what was going to happen at the end. I wrote the last chapter and I didn't change it much, really. Mm-hmm. Second one, I completely rewrote the second half. So I introduced a new character and no, it didn't end how I thought it would at the beginning. But I did know where I was going by the time we got there. The suspect, I went back and forth over the ending. I couldn't couldn't quite decide for a while. It took me a while to get there. And local gone missing. Did I know? I didn't write the end until the end. So no, not really. There were various possibilities. It was fun. You know.
Do you have a way that you celebrate when you get
to the
end?
Let's do that. I know what we'll do. Wonderful relief floods you.
Yeah. Do you take yourself out for dinner? Do you pop a bottle of champagne? What do you do when you finish?
No. I usually cry. No. I'm, you know, the relief that it's over, that I've got there. No. And then you feel terribly flat. Because the build-up to sending your first draft off, you know, I'm terrible for skidding up to the finish line. I send it and then I sit there and think, I did it. And then I'm just exhausted.
Yeah.
It is exhausting.
Yeah. Do you write every day?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Try to, you know, there'll be days when I'm babysitting the grandchildren when I don't, but I'll be thinking about it.
Mm.
You know, it'll be ticking, but I need to, because as soon as you start taking days off, complete days off, it's hard to get going again.
It's a bad habit. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I want to mention again, the name of the book is Local Gone Missing by my guest today, Fiona Barton, and it's published by Berkeley. So thank you so much. This is really fun to talk to you.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Fiona Barton. You can learn more about her work at fionabarton.com. This week's Write the Book prompt is to write about an altercation between someone who lives full-time in a small town and a visitor, seasonal homeowner, or tourist. What sets them off and what preceded the incident for each of them? How does the full-time resident feel about outsiders before this event, and what changes? Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. I'd love to have your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. If you like the show, please rate it where you get your podcasts, like it on Facebook, and talk about it. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We are also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.